Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress Manicure and Press-On Falsies.
This is a true crime podcast, as the title suggests. So please consider this your warning that it's not suitable for children, and it probably will contain content that may be triggering to some people. Also, it's an Australian true crime podcast, so Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners should be aware it may contain the voices of deceased people.
The producers of this podcast recognise the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present, and those emerging.
Weirdly, when I started researching the Paycar ambush, I'd already stumbled upon Lionel Charles Thomas previously and had actually set aside a folder to follow up. And I was like, hang on, I know that name. Holy crap, it's that guy. So then I started digging into that guy, and that guy didn't disappoint. I mean, he was evil, I think is probably not too strong a word to use. I tend not to use that word, but in this case, you know, I'm happy to make the exception.
We're back with Michael Adams from the Forgotten Australian podcast, who I'm sure you'll remember left us at the end of the last episode of Australian True Crime with the name of a crook he believed could be the key to solving an 80-year cold case. That name was Lionel Charles Thomas, but don't get too used to it, because if there was one thing this guy loved, it was changing his name. You'll have to keep your wits about you, because over the course of this episode, as he lies, cheats, murders, but also romances his way around Australia and New Guinea, Lionel will go by no less than three more names. He's definitely a colourful character. It's easy to understand how Michael Adams became so intrigued by him when he popped up in his research.
He was born in 1905 in Victoria. His father had the name of Thomas Thomas. He was a veteran railway worker. Thomas had a daughter first, Florence. He and his wife had Lionel in 1905. In 1925, Florence married a chap called Fred Stevens. So Lionel, Fred, his brother-in-law, and Florence, his sister, were a trio of burglars in Melbourne at the sort of start of the Depression. From sort of about September 1930, for about 6 months in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne, there were just these string of burglaries. They hit house after house. In some cases, they hit like a shop. One shop, they hit three times. They really made Melbourne's cops look like flatfoots. Finally, the police finally worked out who it was. They arrested Lionel and they arrested his sister Florence. But Fred had been walking home and had seen the cop cars out the front, or cars he recognised as belonging to the police, and he'd legged it. So Lionel and his sister, I mean, it made for a great headline in, you know, the Argus and the Age, you know, siblings arrested for burglary, you know, brother-sister team. They were arrested, charged, and they were going to be committed to trial. And Fred was in the wind, and he probably felt like a bit of a cad, given, you know, his wife was in stir and he was out free. So he turned himself in, and he seemed to have done a deal with the cops. So the charges were dropped against Florence, and Fred and Lionel both pleaded guilty. It seemed like a deal had been done. So he and his brother-in-law both got sentenced to about 3.5 years in Pentridge. They were both released in June and July in 1934. So Lionel, he hooked up with a woman called Muriel Croft. Now, Muriel's husband, Thomas Croft, had not so long ago been convicted of a sex offence against a minor and had been given a suspended sentence. So he was a bit of a creep, but because it was a suspended sentence, he didn't have a criminal record like Lionel did, having just come out of Pentridge for, you know, doing 3 years for a string of burglaries. So Muriel suggested to Lionel, hey, why don't you become Thomas Croft? So for the next little while, that's how we will refer to him sometimes, as Thomas Croft. I'm assuming he could pass himself off because, you know, she could supply papers that, you know, proved his identity as Thomas Croft. So we'll just press pause on Thomas Croft at this point. On the 1st of October 1934, so we're talking 3 months after he got out of jail, at Carnegie Station, a station master named Tom Norwood was doing the night shift when someone came up to his office window as he was counting money that he was going to put onto a pay train bound for Melbourne. Was counting money, it was £137, I think, all up. This guy stuck a gun at him and said, "Give me the money." Now, Tom Norwood, the station master, was behind a security grill, and he made the mistake of turning and running, trying to get out of sight, and this assailant shot him twice in the back. People at the station had heard the shots. They called for assistance. Some porters ran across. One man was seen running from the scene. He was tall, between about 25 and 35, dark-haired. So the police converged on the scene. The station master, Tom Norwood, bled out. He died there. The bullets, you know, pierced both of his lungs and grazed his heart. He had a wife and a small child. I mean, this guy was from a family upcountry Victoria. Their young daughter had died when Tom was about 7, and then his older brother had died at Gallipoli. So the Norwood family had known a fair bit of tragedy, and now their son Tom had just been gunned down, and the money was out of reach. The guy who'd done the shooting had tried to peel back the grill, the security grill, and hadn't been able to get it. So this guy had died for nothing. It was a big manhunt, lots of investigations. They had witnesses who said they'd be able to identify the assailant, but they kind of hit a dead end pretty quickly. Now we cut to Sydney, 5 weeks later, November 1934. It's the Depression. We're on Oxford Street, Darlinghurst. And two men who work for Wynn's department store, which has a shopfront on Oxford Street, but also a larger shop set back on Liverpool Street, which is connected by a laneway with steps. These two guys are walking along, one handle each, carrying a bag of money. And as they enter the laneway, two men run up behind them, rub pepper into their eyes, grab the bag, and run along the laneway down the steps to a waiting car. Now, witnesses said that there'd been two girls, young women, staking the place out, and one of them gave a signal to these men as these guys approached. Now, the two men with the pepper in their eyes ran after these robbers and tried to stop them. One of them actually grabbed onto the back of the bumper bar of the car. One of the robbers leaned out, said, "Let go." The bloke didn't, so he shot him. He shot him in the groin. The guy fell down. The car roared off. It was a stolen car, which was recovered later. There were plenty of witnesses, but they gave varying descriptions. The guy survived, the guy who was shot in the groin, but, you know, that was more good luck than anything else. But, you know, whoever was caught for this, if they were convicted, they'd face attempted murder, and that was a capital offence. You'd get a death sentence for it. It might be commuted, but you would get a death sentence for it. So we cut now again to August 1935. About half a mile from where the first pepper robbery was, a guy is walking with a man who's about to buy two Ford motor vehicles. They've just gone to the bank and they've got out about £700, which is the money to be used in the purchase. And as they're walking along, a man jumps up from behind a car and throws pepper into the eyes of the man who's going to buy the car. He's wearing glasses, however, so the pepper doesn't get right into his eyes. The assailant grabs the bag of money and legs it. And again, people have said that they've seen two women casing this area previously. The victim chases after the man. The man turns and punches him in the face, knocks out three of his teeth, breaks his glasses. The guy still gives chase, but the assailant gets away. The police are very, very interested in the other man who was there. He was the one who'd organised this deal, who'd accompanied this man to the bank, who'd actually specified that particular bank and specified park in this particular lane. And also, this guy hadn't been hit with a pepper, but he'd pretty much handed the bag to the assailant. Under pressure, this guy cracked and said, "Yep, I set him up. I was involved." His name was O'Connell. We're going to come back to him, George O'Connell. So the cops quickly had an idea that the man they were after was Lionel Charles Thomas, aka Thomas Croft, who by this stage was living in Sydney with his fake wife, Muriel Croft, whose real husband's name he'd taken. And they put out a warrant for his arrest. And a couple of weeks later, a police sergeant saw him on the street, said, "Stick him up." And Lionel kind of reached for his pocket and then thought better of it and was arrested. And they found him with a fully loaded pistol. He had an unlicensed gun. The two men were committed to stand trial. Long story short, they were convicted. So our man Lionel Thomas Croft is found guilty. He's sentenced to, I think, 4.5 years all told, because he's also sentenced for that unlicensed pistol. I mean, the judge says, you know, "Why did you have it?" He said, "Oh, you know, it's just as a bluff." He's like, "Well, why are you bluffing anyone with a loaded pistol?" The judge said, "Men who carry loaded pistols tend to use them in moments of panic." I mean, any Melbourne detective hearing that might have thought about the Carnegie case and thought, interesting, this guy was down here at that point. Remember that they were convicting him of the pepper robbery where a gun hadn't been used. But, you know, 8 months before that, there'd been another pepper robbery where the guy had been shot in the groin. Well, they now put him on trial for that as well. So now Lionel was, you know, already in jail for 4.5 years, but he was facing trial for the attempted murder of this man in that first pepper robbery. So at the time, the newspaper said, you know, there were numerous witnesses. This time, the police actually produced a police constable who'd been supposedly on holidays in Sydney and had witnessed that first pepper robbery and the shooting. And he identified Lionel Charles Thomas, aka Thomas Croft. That's pretty hard to beat, but Lionel could beat it. He actually had a witness from his next door neighbour in Castlemaine in Victoria, who gave evidence to say that Lionel had been at his parents' home at that time in Melbourne. So there's no way he could have committed this crime. So after the jury heard that, when they retired, it took them 5 minutes to find Lionel not guilty. Now, this witness for the defence was a prison warder at Pentridge. And he'd been, for a decade, he'd done that job. And prior to that, for 6 years, he'd been a policeman. So he had 16 years of law enforcement. He was, you know, equally as credible as the prosecution witness, the policeman.
Great alibi. Wow.
Great alibi. Only problem being that later, the Pentridge warder said that he'd been misled into providing this alibi. It seems to me that Lionel Charles Thomas had actually been down at his parents' place at Castlemaine. And he'd either duped this guy into misremembering the dates, or perhaps from jail had managed to threaten this guy or even bribe him into giving this false evidence. But it was enough to get Lionel Charles Thomas acquitted of attempted murder.
But, I mean, he's still in Sydney.
He's still in Sydney and he's in jail. So when he's released, he returns to Melbourne and he's living up at Swan Hill with his folks. At the same time, his former accomplice, O'Connell, is also released. And O'Connell goes to the police in Melbourne in 1939 and says, Lionel Charles Thomas, a.k.a. Thomas Croft, told me a bunch of things when we were knocking around together, and he basically confessed to the Carnegie Station Master murder. Now, this is a, you know, former crook who's just gotten out of jail. He's been jailed for doing a crime with Lionel Charles Thomas. You know, does this guy have a grudge? Is he trying to set him up? Did his confession actually happen? In any event, the police go up to Swan Hill and they interview Lionel Charles Thomas for 7 hours, and he maintains he wasn't even in Melbourne in 1934, except briefly, which is clearly a lie because he'd been in Pentridge all of the first half of 1934. He claims that, you know, he'd had problems with his wife, so he'd gone up to Sydney and then he'd come back briefly when they were going to reconcile, and then he'd gone back to Sydney. I mean, clearly he needs to make sure that this alibi aligns with the other alibi that he gave in court that got him off the attempted murder charge. Anyway, he's not charged, and that's the end of the investigation into the Carnegie murder at that point. Later that year, just before the war starts, his brother-in-law, Frederick Stevens, is arrested and goes to trial for burglaries. It's a hung jury, and he's going to be tried again. At this point, Lionel Charles Thomas enlists in the army. Australia's now at war with Germany. He signs up, and he's in basic training. Now, is he in basic training because he actually wants to defend Australia? Or is he thinking that if he gets into the army and is shipped off somewhere, he can possibly beat another charge? So he's actually in training in October when he's arrested for this burglary. And the charges against Fred Stevens, his brother-in-law, are dropped, not proceeded with. And Lionel Charles Thomas is convicted and does 2 years in Pentridge. So he's certainly out of military uniform, but he's back in prison uniform. So he gets out of Pentridge in July the 7th. And 5 months to the day later, the Yandera pay car is blown off its tracks and three men are killed in New South Wales. So Lionel, as we know, has, you know, got potential form for shooting people during robberies, has been involved with railway robberies, is, you know, supposedly responsible for the murder of the Carnegie Station Master, has been interviewed about that, etc., etc. You look at his photo, and in terms of, you know, the description of the men who are the suspects in the Yandera pay car, he fits it to a T, exactly the right age, the right height. He had really heavy dark eyebrows, really dark hair, kind of, you know, tan complexion. You know, he was bang on for the actual suspects. Lionel is in the wind. He has spent, we're in, you know, at the end of 1941 now. His first prison sentence was in 1931 in Melbourne, and subsequently he's spent 8 of the past 10 years behind bars. So he's no criminal mastermind. He's not managed to stay sort of, you know, off the radar for very long. And yet now he's absolutely nowhere to be found. So we're going to cut again, and we're going to cut to 1945, when his former accomplice, O'Connell, again goes to the Melbourne police and says, Lionel Charles Thomas, a.k.a. Thomas Croft, is the man who killed the Carnegie Station Master. And this time there's another witness, and she's a nurse formerly from Sydney who lived with Lionel Charles Thomas in Sydney at the time, and she also tells the police that he spoke of committing this murder back in 1934. They both say that, you know, he confessed to them that he'd done this shooting, that the station master had been stupid and had gone for the phone. He'd had to plug this guy. He'd thrown away the gun. He'd said things like, you know, if I ever get caught in Melbourne, I'm done for, et cetera, et cetera. Now that they had two witnesses, they took the allegations a bit more seriously. They went up to Swan Hill. They interviewed Lionel there. He denied all knowledge. They said, look, you know, you're going to have to come on the train back to Russell Street with us. On the train, you know, it was a 14-hour trip, denied all knowledge, continued to deny everything in Russell Street. And then after 28 hours of interrogation, he suddenly confessed. He said, yep, I did it. The gun just went off. I didn't mean to shoot the man dead, etc., etc., but yeah, I did it. They now charged him with the murder of the station master in 1934.
Do you reckon they hung him out the sixth floor of Russell Street back
floor,
then?
The fifth floor of Russell Street.
I think this might be the very first time that such an allegation was made.
Really?
Yep. So he went to the committal hearing and his defence was that he had made the confession under torture. At this time, lots of allegations were made against police in various states for verballing, you know, where they basically said in court, this is what he said, he refused to sign the statement, et cetera, stuff like that. You know, the police didn't have to actually interview people with the independent witness. They didn't have, you know, the means to record interviews. So it was, you know, pretty much the police's word versus the crook's word in court or the suspect's word in court, and it would be up to a judge to decide if the police evidence was admissible and then up to a jury to decide who was telling the truth. And in this instance, Lionel Charles Thomas said that he'd been tortured. So the police had handcuffed his hands behind his back. They'd blindfolded him. They'd put a device on his head and tightened it and said, if you don't sign this statement we've typed, we're going to squeeze this until your head pops. The police objected to this, said it was absolute bullshit. No, that none of that happened. The judge committed him to trial for the murder and he went to trial. This trial happened right as the Americans bombed Hiroshima. So, you know, we've got the start of the war with the Japanese happening on the same day as the Yandera Paykar, and the trial began on the day Hiroshima was bombed. So the jury retires and the jury comes back, and in the case of Lionel Charles Thomas, charged with the murder of Station Master Tom Norwood at Carnegie Station in October 1934, they can't decide. It was 11 to 1. 11 guilty, 1 not guilty. So Lionel Charles Thomas went to trial again. And he went to trial in October. And the day he went to trial, POWs, thousands of POWs from Japanese prison camps are arriving in Melbourne to huge parades of people while Lionel Charles Thomas is going again before the court. The jury returns, and in the case of against Lionel Charles Thomas for the murder of Tom Norwood at Carnegie Station on the 1st of October 1934, the verdict is we can't decide. Lionel Charles Thomas goes back to trial in November, and spoiler alert, another hung jury. Lionel Charles Thomas is remanded for a fourth trial in the next sessions in December 1945, and the police drop the charges before it goes ahead. Lionel Charles Thomas walks. Lionel Charles Thomas leaves Melbourne. Given he's just publicly four times in each trial and in the committal hearing told the world the cops tortured him, you can imagine whether he was telling the truth about that or not, best not to be in Melbourne anymore.
No.
So Lionel Charles Thomas resurfaces in Sydney, but now he's not Lionel Charles Thomas and he's not Thomas Croft. He's now Fred Stevens. So he's using his brother-in-law's name. And he hooks up with a woman named Pearl Jackson for a little while until she issues a warrant against him for stealing a ring. But the police can't find him in Sydney. That's because he's gone to the far-flung outpost of Blacktown in the Sydney's west. You know, in the mid-1940s, it was a village surrounded by farms. So it had two police. It was a small place. So Fred Stevens, Lionel Charles Thomas, throughout his career when he wasn't in jail or robbing people, was a baker. So he got work in Blacktown at Hebblewhite's Bakery. He presented himself quite well. You know, he'd lived a fairly tragic life. He'd had a wife and she'd given birth to twins, but they'd died. And then she'd given birth to two more sets of twins. They lived. Then she'd had triplets and they died, and she'd died giving birth to them. So his two twins were in a convent orphanage school, and he himself had a twin brother, and he was also really quite wealthy, and he had a lovely brick home in Ringwood. This is the story he was telling people in Blacktown. He was a sad man of means.
So that was all bullshit?
That was all bullshit.
Oh my God, what an awful story to tell people. So our man Lionel is now going by two aliases. One,
He's pinched from his brother-in-law, Fred Stevens, and the other, Thomas Croft, he's lifted from the husband of one of his partners in crime, Muriel Croft. Whatever he calls himself, he's about to be on the road to New Guinea, would you believe, after the break.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
So this is the story he's putting around, and he meets this woman named Phyllis Page, and she works as a cleaner at Blacktown Council. Phyllis has had a hard life. She was born in 1900, so she's in her mid-40s. She was married to a nice chap named Norman. He was a sportsman and well-known around Blacktown. He was a butcher there, and he died when he was 35 of a stroke, leaving her like right at the start of the Depression with two young children. So she raised these two children, Norman and Jean, raised them as a single mother, worked really hard, and in 1946, she meets Lionel Charles Thomas, a.k.a. Thomas Croft, now going as Fred Stevens, this charming, poor widower, who's actually quite wealthy and, you know, has big plans, and they hit it off. And within, you know, maybe a year, by mid-1947, he's moved into her house as a boarder, and she and he are discussing getting married. But before he came to live with Phyllis, he'd actually been staying with another chap in Blacktown, again as a boarder, and this guy's name was Arthur Graham. And, you know, while Arthur was out, our man helped himself to Arthur's papers, so he had a backup set of ID now and another potential identity that he could use. So this came into play in October of 1948 when he said to Phyllis, you know, who he wanted to marry, I've got to go to Rabaul in New Guinea. I'm going to make some money there, work as a baker. And he enters the country under the name of Arthur Graham, this, you know, stolen identity. He comes back by around October of 1948 and is again living with Phyllis and her, you know, son Norman and daughter Jean. Jean is now married. Her husband also lives in the house, and Jean has just had a baby. So, you know, it's a one big happy family. You know, Phyllis is over the moon. You know, she had a hard time previously as a widow, but now she's got a man who she absolutely adores, Lionel slash Thomas slash Fred. Phyllis is really enjoying life. Our man gets on really well with, you know, the son Norman, so much so that Norman shows him a photograph of his pen pal, and her name is Luba, and Luba lives in Brisbane. She's a sad girl. Her mother died when she was 15. She's only 18 now. Norman was up in Brisbane. He met her. They've kept in touch, and Lionel sees the photo and is quite taken with it, and he steals it later on. So he keeps Luba up here in his mind. Anyway, he goes back to New Guinea again to set himself up, and there he goes on a rampage. It's later reported by a really credible Sun police roundsman that he's becomes quite infamous in Rabaul. He's supposedly involved in assaults on Papuan boys and girls.
What do you mean by assaults, by the way?
As in sexual assaults.
Oh, my God.
Violent assaults. Yeah. He apparently attempts to strangle his employer, Mrs. Black. She's the one who, with her husband, runs the bakery where he works. He apparently plots to kill Mr. Black so that he and a mate can take over the bakery business in Rabaul because there's only one bakery. It's hard to know exactly how much of this is true, but what is true is that he's deported from Papua New Guinea and he's to arrive back in Sydney, but he has to leave the country under the name of Fred Stevens because he's going to be met at Sydney Airport by poor old Phyllis. So he can't really turn up and say, oh, yeah, I'm also known as Arthur Graham. He has to go as Fred. Problem being, as Fred, he's wanted because back in 1946, there was a warrant for his arrest for stealing Pearl Jackson's ring. So when he arrives at Sydney Airport, he's arrested with Phyllis there. She must have been going, what's happening? I'm pretty much sure he would have just said, oh, this is a big misunderstanding, et cetera, et cetera. He's bailed, but he has to face committal hearing for stealing Pearl Jackson's ring. And guess who didn't turn up to the committal hearing? Pearl Jackson. The police had tried to find her, and she was never heard from again. And supposedly, he was heard saying, they'll never find her. She'll never testify. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But in any event, he and Phyllis went back to Blacktown and they made plans now. She was going to sell her house. She was going to marry him. They were going to go on a driving holiday. They were going to drive through the sort of southwest of New South Wales, down across into Victoria, tour around there for 3 months, then come back up to Sydney, and then they were going to go to Papua New Guinea because he told her that his visit, like, you know, while we know that he'd become completely infamous there with all of his, you know, violence and so on, what he told her was he'd established a bakery in Rabaul and was about to start another one. So he was really wealthy, but all of his money, he told her, was tied up in banks there, so he didn't have access to it. So what he wanted her to do was to sell the house. She said, yep, okay, I'll sell the house. And she said, I think it's only fair, though, that the children get half of the money. And he said, sure, that's a very good idea. They'll get their best return, though, if they invest it in my bakeries. So he arranged
everything.
His original
romance scammer.
Yes, oh, yeah. You're so right.
Oh, my God.
He arranged everything through his attorney, his solicitor, Abraham Brindley in Sydney. Abraham Brindley himself had been in the newspapers in the mid-40s, hugely scandalous. He managed to beat the charges, but he also accused the lead detective, Detective Gordon Jack, of being completely corrupt and trying to fit him up. That was of note because Detective Gordon Jack is about to come into this story. So Lionel and Phyllis sold the house. All the money went into trust with this solicitor, Abraham Brindley. But a few days later, Lionel came in with a letter supposedly authorising £850 be paid out to him so he could buy a panel van for their trip, which he did. And then he came back to the solicitor again with another letter supposedly signed by Phyllis for another sort of nearly £800. So of the £1,650 that had come from the sale of the house, he'd taken out £1,600. Phyllis had no idea about this. She told her children the money was still in trust and she'd access it when they got to where they were going. Anyway, at the start of February, off they went. They went to Goulburn, Canberra, Cooma, and then by about the 12th of February, they were on the far south coast at Eden. And they were seen there camping by various people. And in an incredible coincidence, Lionel was sitting on a bridge down there looking at a flooded river when Mr. and Mrs. Black, his former employers in Papua New Guinea, the bakers, drove past. They'd actually opened a bakery in Eden recently and she saw him there and was like, that's him. They were seen by numerous witnesses all over the place and one of these witnesses had kept a diary for 25 years every single day and she noted seeing these people near their campsite. Lionel and Phyllis had promised the children that they would write, that she would write. And she wrote on the 19th of February saying we're having a great time. He's so good at camping. I'm super happy, etc. And that she signed it Darby and Joan. So Darby and Joan's the old sort of colloquialism for, you know, an old couple who are sort of, you know, rambling around together.
Super happy.
Super and happy. Just, yeah, yeah. 2 days later, Darby turned up at Ringwood at his parents' family's home, minus Joan. He didn't mention Phyllis at all. He unloaded the panel van, all the stuff, all the camping stuff was stuck into the garage. Like he hadn't seen his sister Florence and his brother-in-law and former criminal accomplice Fred since he'd been acquitted on those murder charges in 1945. So it was completely out of the blue. He didn't seem stressed. He said to Florence and Fred, how about we do some road trips? So they did. Now, while he'd been tripping around with Phyllis before she disappeared, he'd been writing to Luba, as in...
Oh, the Brisbane girl.
The Brisbane girl. And he'd been signing these letters, Arthur Graham, and he'd been saying to her that he knew her and he wanted to see her. Now, she's like 18 years old. She has a 1.5-year-old child and she's pregnant. She's also recently married. She's in an unhappy marriage. She's, you know, a very vulnerable woman, young woman. She's getting these letters from this guy. She's got no idea who this man is, but he won't let up. He sends her a telegram, all this sort of stuff. Eventually, she responds and he says, I want to come and see you. Can I call you? She says, okay. So he calls and he kind of sweet talks her into saying, you know, when I see you, I'll explain everything. And she says, okay. So he's got a green light to come and visit her. So on his road trip with his brother-in-law and his sister, they go all the way up to Brisbane. He meets Luba. They talk and he says to her, I first met you, first saw you 5 years ago and I fell in love with you. And your mother said to me, wait 5 years. If you still love her, come back then.
Oh, that's so gross. So he's just making up this lie based on what he's learnt from
the letters
Norman
and stuff.
Jr.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so horrible. And using her dead mother against her. And
And she obviously can't check with her mum because her mum's dead. And she also might think, well, this is what my mother wanted just before she died. So he says, can I see you again? And she says, yes. So the next day he comes and sees her. They go off and they have sex. And she said, he says, will you marry me? Will you come away with me? And she says, I don't know. I'm not sure. And he says, look, I've got to go back to Melbourne for 2 weeks, but I'll come back for you on this date. And she says, okay. So he drives his brother-in-law, his sister, back to Melbourne. He comes back up through Sydney, stops in at his lawyer's place. And by this stage, Phyllis's kids are wondering, where is mum? It's been 2 months since they've heard from her. It's mid-April. And they've contacted the solicitor and he's arranged this meeting with Lionel. Lionel's there and he tells Norman, your mother's in Adelaide. She's at the Gresham Hotel there. We're having a fine time. We've gotten married. Everything's cool. I'm just in Sydney on business. I've got to get back. See you later. Norman calls the Gresham Hotel and they say, no, there's no one here by that name, no Phyllis, and you know, no derivatives thereof. And ask Lionel about this as well. And Lionel says, oh, she's probably going to stay with friends at Port Pirie. And then he disappears again. So the kids are kind of like, well, they're kind of, I guess they want to believe their mum's all right. And he's obviously quite convincing. He goes back to Brisbane, hooks up with Luba, takes her off from her husband and her baby. By this time, the child, she's lost the child she was carrying.
Oh,
So they go for a week on a driving tour around sort of northern and then southern western New South Wales, staying in hotels and motels as husband and wife. You know, he says to her, I want you to marry me. He gives her a ring. He gives her a 3-strand pearl necklace, both of which belong to Phyllis. And then they get to Sydney. He goes to visit his solicitor. When he comes out of his solicitor's office, she's been waiting in the car and she says, I miss my boy too much. Can you please take me back home? And he does. He actually takes her back as far as Grafton, at least, and puts her on the train.
That's a miracle. I thought he was going to kill her for sure.
She gives him back the pearl necklace and the wedding band. And she goes back to Brisbane where her husband very soon afterwards divorces her. She loses custody of the child who's put up for adoption.
Oh,
so, you know, it kind of ruined her life anyway.
God.
While he's in Grafton, he stops in to see an old mate called Eric Ridgway. And Eric, during the period he was living with Phyllis, actually did painting for Phyllis. And he will later claim that Lionel had confided in him his plan to murder Phyllis after he got the house into his name. So he will later claim that. Anyway, Lionel then comes back to Sydney, and he kind of realizes, I mean, the kids are asking questions now. It's probably, you know, time to do a big runner. So he goes back to Melbourne. He sells the panel van. He says to his brother and his sister-in-law, I'm going to Perth, and off he goes. So by the 11th of May, he's in Perth. Phyllis is still not officially missing, and the police are not looking for her. One of the first things he does in Perth is place a personal ad, man seeks woman, view matrimony. And he meets...
Oh, my God.
He meets a woman called Jean Cheatham, who is just actually estranged from her husband, who's a grazier. On the first meeting, he proposes marriage, like an hour into it. She's like, whoa, steady on. But she's still willing to keep seeing him, so she does. Like 3 days after that, he chats up a 19-year-old girl who's working as a waitress, and they go for a walk. He walks her home to the boarding house she's staying at. He asks her if she'll marry him. She says, that's silly. I don't even know your name. He says, my name's Arthur Graham. Can I see you again? Next time they see each other, he asks again, will you marry me? They keep dating. He meets her mother. Her mother's really taken with him and basically gives permission for the marriage to go ahead, and they set a date. He gives her a 3-diamond engagement ring, or shows it to her, again, one that belonged to Phyllis. She doesn't like it particularly, so he's going to get the stones reset, but he gives her the 3-strand pearl necklace. Then he has to actually go off to a country town to work. He writes to her, etc., etc. Now, in early June, back in Sydney, Phyllis's son and daughter have finally got the police to take notice, and Detective Gordon Jack, who's been the enemy of Abraham Brindley, the solicitor, is assigned the case, and he and Fred Cray, who's then an upcoming detective and later is one of the most corrupt police to ever walk the earth in Australia, are on this case. And over the next 6 weeks, undercover, completely off the books, posing as guys just on a camping trip, they go following the trail of evidence that we've heard. So from Abraham Brindley's the solicitor, then they go to Goulburn, then Canberra, then Cooma, then the South Coast, then to his family's place in Ringwood, where his sister says, yes, he came here. He didn't mention any Phyllis. He was going to see this girl, Luba. Here's her address, etc. She shows him her diary as well, which, you know, proves the dates and all the stuff that he's stashed in their garage. So the cops then go into Melbourne to the guy who he sold the panel van to, then back to Sydney, then to Brisbane to interview Luba, then back to Sydney, then to Adelaide, finally to Perth. So they cover 10,000 miles in the space of 6 weeks undercover, piecing it all together, particularly the chronology. While he's been in this country town up on the north of Perth, he's actually written to his brother-in-law saying, you know, I've got my life sorted out, you know, I don't need to worry about anything anymore. And he's given an indication of which town he's in. Now, the police have by this stage interviewed the brother-in-law and the sister, and I'm pretty much saying that the brother-in-law and the sister now know exactly what sort of man Lionel Charles Thomas is, because they could have picked up a phone and called him, or they could have sent a telegram and said, clear out, but they didn't. So the police go to this country town where he is, and he's gone by this stage. But they find people who've known him recently, and he said he's going to get married, and his name is Arthur Graham. Now, in WA at this time, notices of marriages had to be posted outside the registry office in Perth. So right there in black and white is Arthur Graham to marry Dorothy Truslove, Saturday 22nd of July at this church. So they go to Dorothy Truslove and say, hey, where's your fiance? They don't identify themselves as detectives. Oh, she says, oh, he's staying at this Crystal Hotel in town. So on Friday, the night of Friday, the 21st of July, 1950, they're waiting in his room when he returns. And he returns with Jean Cheatham, the woman he met through the personals ad. So he's going to have sex with her the night before he gets married to this woman. Now, they arrest him, and he's actually got a book that's called What to Do at Your Wedding in the room. In the room, there's also a picture of him at Katoomba. There's a picture of Luba. There's various items that belong to Phyllis and so on. Jean is actually allowed to leave. She's not implicated at all. He says, oh, look, you know, Phyllis is alive and well. She'll turn up. No problems at all. And they take him in for questioning. he tells his story that, you know, he met her in Adelaide in early May. She knew about his criminal past. And once her kids also knew, she then left him and he hasn't seen her since, but she's obviously fine. And, you know, he says that they were tripping around in the intervening 3 months. Of course, the police know this is not true because they've traced the chronology of who he was with, where and when. So he's arrested, he's charged, and he's extradited to Sydney to face trial, where again, his legal defence team will claim that his statement to the police was completely fabricated. So again, it'll be his defence's word against his word. And again, the statement is ruled admissible. This time, however, they've got like 43 witnesses. I think the transcript of the committal hearing alone goes to 150,000 words. It goes over 15 days. He's ordered to stand trial. This time, there's no hung jury. There's no retrial. The jury retires for less than an hour, and he's found guilty of the murder of Phyllis, even though her body has never been found, and he won't say where it is. Now, the thing is, his statement to the police in Perth was that he, in a rage, shot her in the chest and then threw her off that bridge, weighted down. Now, he claimed it was, you know, he shouldn't have done it. She was a wonderful woman. They didn't get on so well. She'd started nagging him and he'd just, you know, done his lolly and shot her. So I guess, you know, he might have been angling in that statement for manslaughter, maybe. But he completely recanted that statement, said it was completely fabricated, that the shorthand notes had been made up, he hadn't signed anything, etc. And so the police testified that he'd said to them, well, I think I've got a pretty good chance because you're never going to find her now. And they never did. But it was enough for the jury to convict. And at this time in New South Wales, that was an automatic death sentence.
Oh, wow. My God, of course.
Then he appealed. Once the appeal was denied, then it would be up to the executive to decide whether he would hang or not. But before that decision came down, now he had no further recourse to legal action. The police could now reveal to the press all of his criminal past, convicted and alleged. So now the newspaper stories were all about his conviction for the Pepper robbery, the fact that he'd stood trial for attempted murder on that, the fact that he'd stood trial three times for murder, the Melbourne murder of the Carnegie station master, and had been acquitted. And then there were the allegations about what he'd done in Rabaul, et cetera, and the fact that he'd stolen this ring from Pearl Jackson, who'd never been seen again. There was also the allegation that there was another woman in Rabaul he'd been involved with who'd also disappeared. Now, the big headline was, though, the police could finally reveal that he had been their number one suspect in the Yandera pay car bombing. They'd just never been able to prove it against him.
All I can think about is all of the people from the families, the widows, the children of those men killed in that bombing. Phyllis, Pearl, you know, like these are the moments when people get so angry with our legal system and all of that, when you go, you've put me in harm's way. You have put all of us in harm's way, letting this guy walk the earth when you've known the kind of person that he is.
Even the guy who got shot in the groin, I'm thinking, yep. What happened to him? He might have been disabled for his life or something.
Absolutely, and traumatised for sure. Detective Gordon Jack, his life was also ruined. He, just like days after the arrest was made, went into hospital and was in hospital for almost a year with exhaustion, etc. It became pneumonia, all related to the exhaustion of this, you know, extended manhunt. He went back to work. The first thing he did, he said he was going to do, this is September of 1951, was go out to Long Bay to see Lionel Charles Thomas again, to ask him to do the decent thing and say where the body was. But he didn't get to do that because Lionel Charles Thomas hanged himself in his cell. He left a note saying he was innocent. In the note, he said that he couldn't handle the fact that he wasn't allowed to do baking in the jail, and that was the end of him. Gordon Jack was the only person, I think, who was present at the cremation when he was, you know, given a pauper's cremation. Certainly no one else from his family or his friends or anyone was there to see him out of the world, except for, you know, the cop who'd pursued him across literally most of Australia.
But it was also obviously very charming. I've just noticed that on your Facebook page you've got a mugshot, right? An arrest, yep. Some arrest pictures there. And he's got a really smug look on his face.
He does.
And, you know, he looks like, as you're talking about him, I've been looking at this photo of him a lot. He's got a grin. He's got a smarmy grin on his face and he looks like a bloke who's gotten away with a lot.
Now, the question that remains, did he do the Yandera pay car bombing? And it's, you know, it's not very often in these cases, you know, you end up basically with a lot of questions. But in this case, I could say definitively what happened, whether he was responsible or not. So he changed his name, or he went by Frederick Arthur Stevens, his brother-in-law's name. And that was the name he enlisted under when he left Pentridge in July of 1941. So those files are available and I got them digitised. And military files are very, very detailed in where people are, when and where. So he was in training in July of 1941. In October, he was marched out, which means moved from the 3rd Military District, which is Victoria, to the 7th Military District, which is the Northern Territory. So Lionel Charles Thomas was in Darwin in mid-November 1941. His next entry in his military file is January of 1942. That's because he committed a minor offence. So the question was, could he have been in Sydney on the 8th of December 1941? Now, theoretically, you could certainly get from Darwin to Sydney and back in that period, but you couldn't do that as a soldier, and you certainly couldn't do that when Australia was at war. There's no way he would have been able to leave his camp in Darwin without being reported as absent without leave. And even if he could do that, there would have been military checkpoints. There was, you know, rationing in terms of petrol and that sort of thing. To get from Darwin to Sydney in late 1941 would have been a train or car journey of at least, I would think, a week in both directions. And he would also then have had to, you know, case out the whole rail car thing and then, you know, manage to get back after the explosion and so on and so forth. I just think, you know, that's just not possible. So he might have done a lot of bad, bad things, but the Yandera pay car ambush, killing three men, was not one of them. So who knows, you know? I don't think they'll, unless someone finds a diary from their grandfather or great-grandfather confessing to the crime, I think the Yandera pay car will remain unsolved.
What a bombshell. And speaking of bombshells, would you believe there are actually more crimes and misdemeanours of Lionel Charles Thomas that went under the radar because of his incredible capacity to commit them on the same days as major international historical events? I'm not kidding. You can hear all about it on Michael Adams' podcast, Forgotten Australia. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. If you need support after listening to this podcast, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or contact 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732 or 1-800-RESPECT.org.au. Indigenous Australians can contact 13 Yarn on 13 92 76 or 13yarn.org.au. Thank you to our guest, Michael Adams. We'll be back next week.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Australian True Crime, the live show, is coming.